Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about a lot of the process, about how we go from something like a C program to something actually executing. Talk about what that program looks like in the memory of the machine when it's actually running. We have these conventional parts where we put code, data, the stack, and the heap, which you may have learned about in 2150. And we had to get the things there, and part of those things were in the program that's stored on disk. And we talked about how we get from a source file to that executable on disk, which we basically just copy into a particular region of memory. And given that, what the intermediate steps were. So we had the object file, which it takes the assembly file, which you learned about in 2150, and converts it to machine code, but doesn't decide everything yet. We have these placeholders where we're going to put addresses, because we don't know where we're going to put everything in memory yet. And then we have linking, where we take those object files and actually make the decision about where does everything go in memory and fill in those placeholders. Okay, so question?
So I think last class you said that there's a direct conversion from C to machine code, or I'm sorry, from C to assembly, because that's just the way C is defined, but sometimes the compiler will take more indirect ways that it thinks are more efficient.
Yeah, so the question is about the first step, which I kind of glossed over since it's mostly 2150 talk, of going from C to assembly. Yeah, so as I said, the reason we're using C in this class is because there is a direct conversion. There's a straightforward way of writing assembly given C code. But there's a warning that this may not be what your compiler does. And probably today, if not today, on Thursday, we'll see a glaring example of the compiler not doing the straightforward thing. Yeah?
So going from assembly to machine code, is there like a similar step where there's a direct conversion but a compiler might take an indirect method?
So the question is, just like a C compiler when going from C to assembly might not do what you expect, does an assembler going from assembly to object files sometimes not do what you expect? And the answer is no. Like the conversion is very well defined. There's not much leeway there. So we're not going to have any surprises like that. When we learn about our particular assembly language, there's going to be one way of converting it into machine code and no others. So we're not going to have that issue. That's compile, assemble, link, so you should know that process. And we also started talking about C, our high-level language, and we're going to talk about a whole mess of things which aren't particularly related, and I've messed up in trying to pretend I'm presenting them in a particular order, but there's not really a great one, of just things you didn't really learn in 2150 about C that we'd like you to know. And the first thing we talked about was pointer arithmetic, which is how arrays work in C. So arrays in Cs are really just manipulating memory addresses. That's how they work. And we have these operators, which correspond directly to array accesses, which actually like add something to a pointer, and the assembly they compile into typically just adds something to a memory address. That's what the conversion is. And we'll talk a little bit more about that today, along with a whole bunch of other miscellaneous C topics that we want you to know by the time you finish this class, and so you can do better when we use C later on in this class. So any questions on anything we covered last time? Okay, so let's take a little diversion into anonymous feedback. So I said I would read anonymous feedback, and I do, and sometimes I'll talk about it, sometimes I won't. So one question was, are there good videos, presumably not the lecture recordings, but you know, someone else with a different perspective who might be better, on this course's topics? And I'm not sure I know great sources for that. So there are other computer architecture courses which might be worth looking at. For example, there are videos from CMU and Georgia Tech Online, but they don't cover quite the same topics. In particular, in this part of the course, where we're kind of filling in holes from 2150, you're not likely to find something from elsewhere which does quite exactly the same stuff, because other places don't really have a 2150 that looks like our 2150. But for other particular topics later on the semester, there are resources like this where they might have their own explanations that you might find easier to understand than what I do, and that would be fine. The biggest warning is that even though we're teaching the same basic concepts, it's very common to use a completely different instruction set, which usually makes it really hard to use material from another course, even if it's the same stuff. So another piece of anonymous feedback was that everything was pretty ambiguous. And I believe you. Like, I made lots of mistakes. There are lots of things I think I did wrong, fumbling over things, not remembering things, what's on my slide, not presenting things with enough detail. Like, I can think of lots of things I think I did wrong. But if you just tell me it was pretty ambiguous, I'm going to make my guesses. And most of the time, what I think I did wrong is not what you all think I did wrong. So if you want things to actually improve rather than just venting, which is fine, venting on anonymous feedback, perfectly okay with me. But if you want me to actually improve things, you need to be more specific, because otherwise I'm going to guess as to what I did wrong, and it's probably not what you think was bad. So just be more specific if you want me to act on things. And another question was, can quizzes be done on Tuesday? So why did I have the quiz due on Saturday? Do I hate your weekends? So there's a reasoning behind this. It's not just because I like having earlier deadlines. So when we have reading quizzes, which we'll probably do not next week, but the following week, because I assume you can get a textbook by then, we'll have a quiz on the lecture and lab material that you'll do between Thursday and Saturday, and a quiz on the reading you'll do between Sunday and Tuesday. And the idea is that you have the results of the post-lecture quiz before you do the reading quiz, so you know if you completely misunderstood something in the previous week and can try to fix that. And I'm just keeping that schedule now, so when we start having reading quizzes, no one sends me lots of emails saying I missed the quiz because I thought it would be due Tuesday. I hope that makes sense. I know everyone would like later deadlines, but have to keep some schedule to not have everything all do at the same time. Okay, so speaking about the quiz, let's talk a little about questions on the quiz. Particular ones that people had more trouble with than others. So there are a bunch of true-false about object files. So one was that the object file contains information about where in the machine code memory addresses will be when the program runs. And this is exactly the relocations, those placeholders, which tell the linker, hey, put a memory address here. And because we have those placeholders, we're telling the linker where there will be a memory address, because the linker is responsible for putting it there in the file. So that we know must be in the object files because the linker does that. There's another true-false, which was it contains the names of labels from the corresponding assembly file. And part of the linker's process of filling in those placeholders is that it needs to know what to fill them in with, and it uses the names. We also need to be able to find where those memory addresses being referred to are. For example, when we had main define in our .o file, or we had some other .o file which defined puts, we need to know where each of those names are. We're using the name in the assembly file, and that's the only thing we expect to match between the two assembly files, so it has to use the name to do that, so the names must be in the object file. This makes sense to everyone? Questions? And the third true-false, which was the most wrong question on the quiz, was in addition to the machine code itself, the object file contains information about where each instruction starts in the machine code. And the thing I wanted to get at here is though we could like look at the machine code and decode each instruction, though we haven't told you how to do that, that's not something that the linker needs to care about. There's no reason for the linker to care what any of the individual instructions do or exactly where they are. It only needs to know about the placeholders and the locations the label specify. Any more detail, the linker doesn't do anything with. It just copies the segment of machine code directly to the executable as is. So there's no need for this extra level of detail, so it's not there. And I probably should have bolded plus italicized each, because that is a key word in this, because there is the location of some of the instructions, like the ones with labels, are definitely specified in the object file. So there's also a question on endianness, which, you know, I was hoping to get 100% on, didn't. So it would have been better if I had said in memory, because I said followed by, and from our idea of arrays, which is how I want you to think about things. You know, if we say array element follows another in memory, we mean consecutive addresses. We never go backwards in addresses. That's the sort of impression I was trying to get. I apologize if you got it wrong for that reason, but I don't think it was unclear enough that I'm gonna remove it. Yes?
What are labels? Like, is that
name? So what are labels? So labels are things like, things like main, colon, I do not have my proper quote here, etc., that we can refer to in assembly by name.
So is data and text also labels?
So the question is, data and text also labels? So this is a question we glossed over, whether that's true or not, and the real answer is probably sort of. We're not going to ask you about it because it, how they're treated varies. Yes.
In the first lecture, you gave an example like a circuit that adds up numbers, the counter, I think.
Yeah.
And the first example you gave didn't work because you said that the circuit was unstable because it's probably impossible for some logic to be able to manipulate two wires at the same time, or to be able to change the wires at exactly the same time. And so that was the reason that we needed to add like a storage device, I guess?
Yes.
That has a clock signal running through it?
Yeah, so the question is about my example from last week of an unstable circuit. And that the justification was we couldn't build it without storage. And I assume your confusion is why can't we build the circuit that exactly synchronizes the output?
Well, my question is, I think on the first day of class you said we're not concerned about very low level electrical engineering problems, like how transistors work and how gates and simple logic like that works. And so I'm curious why you can't just assume that the logic is designed in a way that takes care of all of the hardware problems.
Okay, so the question is about what we're dealing with in this course. So we're glossing over how the hardware actually works. So why did I introduce you to this very low-level hardware issue that we seem to be really far away from right now? And the issue is that there's some things where we're not going to go over exactly why that circuit is unstable in like complete detail, but where part of our job as a processor designer is going to need to deal with those details of what the hardware does. In particular, we do need to care about placing storage because of this instability. Like that's something we need to know about as a hardware designer. We can't just tell someone else, please make this not do that. That's not going to be an option that's efficient. Like they can build that sort of circuit for us, but it's going to be a lot less efficient and not acceptable for building a processor. So there's some issues we'll deal with, but for the most part, we'll only ignore them, just the ones that affect how we design our processors.
So potentially there are like other electrical engineering problems that might come up that we might not.
So the question is, are there other electrical engineering problems that might come up? So yes, there are a whole bunch of electrical engineering issues that are really electrical engineering things that come up when we're building processors. So we'll talk about some of them at sort of a very glossed over level, like the unstable circuit, that's a very glossed over level. I didn't talk about what exactly the transistors were doing that caused that and when it would be good or bad in particular. And we'll talk about other things at that sort of high level, like whether things are slow or fast because of the hardware issues. But we're not gonna dig deeply into things we might do in an electrical engineering issue to make that better or worse. But yeah, we can't ignore that there's interaction between the physics of the hardware and what we're building. Okay. Any other questions before we go on to today's material? Okay, so one last note on the quiz. So we randomized the order of the answer letters for everyone. So please don't refer to them in the comments, because the grader sees the quiz question in one particular order, which isn't the one you saw. So like, please just like quote the answer option. It makes things much easier for us. Yes? So the question is, what do you use the comments for? So the comments are, if you think the question isn't clear, or you think you need to otherwise explain your answer, use the comments for that. So what will we, so like, we'll give you credit for a wrong answer in the comments if the comment suggests you knew everything that was going on, you just interpreted something differently, or made some trivial mistake that we don't care about, like a math error. Okay. And one final logistical issue, which is lab this week. So there is lab tomorrow. You will download from us a 64-bit Linux executable, and you're going to use a debugger and other tools that are discussed in the lab to figure out what input it expects. The tools we suggest output AT&T syntax assembly by default. You are welcome to read AT&T syntax assembly, but if you don't want to do that, the lab write-up mentions how to make each of these tools output Intel syntax assembly, which is what you saw in 2150. So if you have problems with AT&T syntax, please use that. In theory, this is all 2150 stuff. You learned all the assembly you should need from 2150. In practice, well, we're reviewing assembly later this week, so you can guess what I think about what you actually remember about assembly. So any questions on the lab assignment? Yes?
Will exams be an AT&T or Intel syntax?
So for the rest of this course, after this assignment, we will be using AT&T syntax. Though you're, of course, welcome to continue to use tools that don't output that. Mainly because our textbook uses it, and we will supply you some tools which only accept AT&T syntax. Yes?
Is there a pre-lab section that we have to get down to the lab?
So the question is there a pre-lab? No. There will generally not be a pre-lab for any of the labs. There will be a homework following the lab, which for this lab is with the same executable. You do part of it in lab, and an additional part for homework that's due by next week. But there's no pre-lab part. We intend all the labs to be something you could just go to lab and finish in 75 minutes. Yes?
If it's a Linux executable, can you do it on OS X?
Question is, since it's a Linux executable, can we do this on OS X? It's probably difficult, maybe with the VM. Our supported platform is you SSH into a lab machine. Okay, any other questions about the lab? Great, so let's go back to what we were talking about last time, which is arrays and pointers. So the big thing about arrays and pointers in C is that array accesses are exactly the same as doing this pointer arithmetic, that manipulating the address of a pointer, either the pointer you started with, or taking an array you provided and getting a pointer to its first element, and then changing that memory address. So arrays, when you try to use them to do indexing, turn into a pointer, and that pointer is then added to or subtracted from, and that's what you dereference. And that's how all arrays work in C. And this includes cases we didn't see last time, where the array isn't an array of bytes, but is an array of something else, like integers. So on our lab machines, ints are 4 bytes, and C just makes it so this arithmetic still always works for accessing different parts of the array, which means adding 2 to a pointer to an int advances by 2 ints, which means that we actually add 8 instead of 4. And the compiler will generate assembly code that adds 8 to do this. Okay. and will scale up, however you do, and it's being done based on the type of the pointer. So the compiler knows to do this because the pointer is defined as an int star and not a char star. So any questions about how this works? Yes? So for plus 2, it adds 2 times 4, because 4 is the size of an int. So it advances by 2 ints worth. And it's always in the units of the type you declared the pointer. Other questions? Yeah?
What if you're using like an object that has an undefined memory size?
So the question is, what if the object has an undefined memory size? Then this is an error. And we are probably not going to talk about how that can happen. Okay. So from what I've shown you before, it may seem like arrays and pointers are just always the same thing. Why do they even have different types? The only difference is whether they're declared with memory or without. And that's not quite true. So once you've declared them, they mostly act the same. But for example, while you can assign a pointer to an array and get a pointer to the first element of the array, you can't assign array to a pointer and change where an array is located. That's not allowed. You could imagine making this work either by relocating the array or copying from the pointer. The C compilers just don't do that. It's just an error. Another big difference is that arrays are a different type. So pointers, they're just an address. Arrays actually keep track of being an array and know their size. So if you ask with the size of operator, this is an operator, not a function, because it accepts things a function couldn't do. You ask the size of operator, how big is this array of 100 ints? It's on our lab machines, it'll tell you 400. You can store 4 times 100 bytes. If you ask what's the size of this pointer, it's going to tell you it's 8 because it's a memory address. And a memory address on our lab machines takes up 8 bytes. It doesn't matter what it points to, it's still a memory address. Yes? So the question is, does size of not count the overhead, like if there's extra space needed to allocate this array? So it indeed does not. So if there's other stuff around in memory, size of won't tell you about that. It will always be the case that it will be the size of whatever's in the array times the number of elements. And how about this? What should this be? So anyone want to volunteer what they think that would make most sense for that? Yes.
8.
So why 8?
Because it's an address?
Yes. So this is asking explicitly for the address of the first element, and that's an address, so it's going to give us the size of an address. It doesn't remember anything about the array, it's just an address now. So that would be, in fact, 8. So any questions about any of these sizing things? Okay. So this last example brings up something about precedence that I just want to mention because it's tripped people up in the past. Which is that, so in the case of array indexing, if I take address foo at 1, that takes the address after doing the array indexing. If I dereference something, that does the array indexing and dereferences the result. It doesn't do the other way around. If you want the other thing, you have to write it explicitly. And the second case in particular is surprising to people. This also happens with Similarly with the plus plus, the post increment and post decrement operators. Those are valid on pointers. They just add or subtract one, which gets turned into add or subtracting whatever the size of the thing pointed to is. But if you do star foo plus plus, that says do foo plus plus and then dereference the result of that, which is not what a lot of people expect. But for better or worse, you will see a lot of all of these in real C code. Any questions on these precedence issues? Okay, so those out of the way, I'll briefly switch over to a seemingly non-C topic and talk about the command line. So you've used the Linux command line in the past, I assume. And I'd like to just tell you about a few things that we'd like you to know about so you aren't wasting your own time in lab. So one thing is that probably typically what most of you do when you want to figure out how to do something in the command line is you take out your favorite search engine and look for some information about that. And that's fine, but there's also some official documentation on our machines. And this is accessed with the man command. Man stands for manual. And like any good command, you can, that deals with documentation. It has documentation. And you can look up its documentation using itself. So man pulls up the manual page for man, an interface to the online reference manuals. And this is a very long and very complete document that you could read. But an interesting place to skip to in many manual pages for commands is the example section. So here we can find out that, hey, if you want to find out information about the program ls, you check manls. Sometimes there's multiple manual pages with the same name, and you can use -a to see all of them. There's some other interesting options like -k searches descriptions and names for a word, so you can look for all things that mention printf, not just the thing called printf in the title. And there's a whole bunch of other options to this command. And there's another command I'd like to mention, which is, besides man, that you probably haven't really used, called chmod. So we can look up the manual for chmod. So who's used this before? Anyone who knows what it does? Okay, a lot less people. And if you look at the man page, you don't actually learn very much about what it does from the top. It just says change file mode bits, whatever those are. So the big thing chmod does is control permissions to access files, whether you or other people can do certain things with files. And I'd go to the example section of this manual page, but there isn't one. So I have an example myself. So here's an example of an interesting chmod command. So we have one option there, --- recursive, which says do something to the file mode bits for not just /home user, this file directory I'm specifying, but everything contained within it. So it and all subdirectories and files. And then we have this weird OG minus R thing, which we can decode as follows, and the manual page explains all this if you read very carefully. So O and G stands for others and group. So it says for other users who aren't covered anyway other way, and for users in the same group as me, which if you're logged into the lab machines, you're in a group called student. And then there's a minus. Minus means remove some ability to access files, and R for read. And surprisingly on our lab machines, this does something, because your home directory on the lab machines is by default world readable by everyone. Probably shouldn't be, but this is how you would fix that. So there are also other options there. So there's, in addition to group and others, you can specify at the beginning you for user, meaning the user who owns the files, which would be you yourself, You can add permissions, and there's read, write, execute, or on directories, something called search. So another case where this might come up is like if you transfer a binary file that you went to execute, and you try to execute it and you get permission denied, well, this is how you fix that. You add the X for execute permission for you, and then you won't get permission denied when you try to execute that file you copied over and somehow didn't get set up right. And similarly, if you somehow manage to copy over a file that's not writable, this is how you'd fix that. Any questions about chmod? And there's another utility we use, which I could also show you the man page for, but I'll give you a brief description of the things you care about, which is tar. So this is the standard Linux Unix archiving utility, which we care about because we're often going to give you a tar archive of labs. And no, you do not need to have physical access to the lab machines to use this. You can do it all remotely via SSH. So the way you deal with tar archives remotely, you copy them over to the machine you're accessing, and then you can use these commands from the command line. So there's the T for table of contents command. So tar space TF and a file will list all the files in a tar archive without messing up your home directory by spilling files everywhere. There's X for extract, which you can use to extract all the files in the directory you're currently in. So XVF extracts them and is V for verbose, so it shows you what it's extracting. If you omit the V, it will still do the same thing, but it won't tell you anything about the files it created. You'll just have to find out. And the F means I'm specifying a file name. And you can also create new archives if you want to do that. The tar command is really weird in that, you know, it doesn't accept options the way you're probably used to from any other commands. And you also have to specify F all the time for some reason. F stands for file. So the history here is that the default is tape. Those tape drives we definitely have connected to our lab machines. So you have to say, no, I don't want the tape. I want a file on disk. But that's how it works. And this is just letting you know because you'll have to do this very many of our labs where we'll give you something to extract and use in your home directory. And yes, you should be able to do that even if you don't have a GUI. Any questions on tar? Okay. So a final sort of quality of life issue is tab completion and history. So we often see many people laboriously typing out long file names and commands, and you can often avoid that. So for example, I know I have a directory where I keep my stuff for this course, which starts with fall 2017, so I'll just type the beginning of that name and press tab. And look, there's no other directory that was a candidate, so it typed the rest of that for me. I don't need to actually type it out and make an annoying typo. And I can keep doing this. So I know there's something on this course with that. Starts with CS, doesn't complete. If I press tab twice, it shows me, oh, there's two things with that name. Let's start with CS. And those are your options. And I don't need to stop typing that command. I can type enough to disambiguate that. Then press tab, and it types the rest for me. So if you don't know about this, this usually saves people a lot of time. I can keep doing that, for example. So another thing is that there's history. So if I press the up arrow key, I get previous commands I've typed. For some reason, I don't get the CD command. But commands I've typed. So let's say I ran this command. So I could just retype the whole thing, or if I preferred, I can press up arrow and recall that command. And I can use the arrow keys to edit it a little bit to fix it, rather than actually going through the process of retyping it. It doesn't matter so much for a nice short command like this. But often I see people like typing out some long file name and they make a typo somewhere and then they retype the whole thing and I'm watching them in my office hours and I'm, why are we wasting so much time? So hopefully we can avoid you. Any questions on tab completion history? Okay, so with that diversion, let's go back to C and give you an explanation for why I just put that diversion here. So in C++, you probably used IOStream, which is home to many wonderful things like Cout and Cin. C doesn't have that, just doesn't exist. Instead, you have standard IOTAH. And standard IOTAH has completely different things. And you might say, well, how do I look up what I can do in standard IO? I mean, you could like search online or look in your textbook. But in addition to having information about commands, the man command has information about C functions. So if I type man standard IO, I get the documentation for everything in standard IO.h. Now this is the official sort of reference documentation, so maybe it's not the easiest thing to read, maybe you'll prefer to search, but this is the authoritative source which tells you what's on the machine. So you can see that, oh, there's a standard in, standard out, and standard error that we defined. If we scroll down further here, we get a list of functions. So you can look through this list and say, figure out where is a function to like read a character, something like that. You can look through here and find the function you're looking for. And each of these functions has their own manual page, which you can access with the man command again. And this is going to be generally true for all the C facilities we're talking about in this course. We're not going to use many of them, but you should know about it rather than sort of scrounging out around online for documentation which might not even, you know, be accurate for our machines. And there's one particular function here which we'll use the most, which is printf. And I'll start with an example of what printf looks like. So printf is our closest equivalent of cout. And you know, so here's an example with cout versus printf. And in printf, whereas in cout, we just interrupt the line and actually put our variable we want to print out in there. In printf, we have this template with placeholders marked with a percent sign for each of the things we want to output that aren't part of a fixed string. And we need to have the placeholders correspond to the arguments. In particular, because I'm outputting here an integer here, and this cus no is an integer, I needed to use %d and not %s. I use %s for the second one because it's a string, and that's the thing which corresponds to a string. And I need to have the things in what is called the format string, which is this string here, match exactly with the types that it expects. If you don't do that, you might get an error. It might crash. Basically what happens usually is the compiler will pass the type you specified and printf will try to interpret it as the type it thinks it should be, and lots of things could happen. So you need to be careful about that. And I've shown you this example. Well, if you want an int printed out as a decimal, use %d. If you want a string, use %s. And there are a whole bunch of other options. But before I talk about those, is this example clear to people? Any questions? Yeah. So I have a brief table of subsets of the things printf supports, which you can refer to. We're not going to have you memorize it, but you should know what they are, including the type it expects and the format of output. You'll notice that there's, for example, multiple ways to output integers, depending on whether you want hexadecimal or decimal. Use a different thing after the percent sign to do it. Also, if you happen to want to output a percent sign in your string, You can use 2% signs to specify that, since there's otherwise it's looking at the next character and doing something special. Yes. So the question is, so I want to print something in array. Do I use the placeholder for the number? And I'm not sure what the rest is, but you just pass, you access an element of the array and pass that. You can't print out the whole array at once. If you want to do that, you need to write your own loop. Like if it doesn't match the type here, you need to convert it to that to use this. You can't expect any cleverness to happen whatsoever. So if you want to know more about, you know, other things printf does, if you actually at some point need to format output very precisely, which you shouldn't for this course, but in coding C, it's likely to come up that you'll like care about how many digits you have after a decimal and things like that. You can find out in the manual page for printf, which you can access with man space 3 space printf. And you might reasonably ask, where did that 3 come from? And I wouldn't expect you to know that, certainly. So if we look at, if we type man printf, you might think, well, we're gonna get the documentation for that C function. And it sort of kind of looks like we do, but this isn't that. This is the documentation for a command line command called printf, which is similar, but not a C function. And if you may remember, I briefly showed you in the documentation for man, I mentioned you could get multiple manual pages for things with the dash a command. So if we do that with printf, we first get this for the command called printf. Then it says, oh, next I have something called printf parentheses 3. Don't know why it's a 3. Do you want to see that? Well, yes, I do. Oh, that looks better. And that's how I found out it was 3. And sometimes you'll come across other C functions, which are also the names of commands or other things, so you'll need to disambiguate this way to find the manual page for it. But here, this is the documentation for printf, which has lots and lots and lots of text if you want to find out exactly how to do something. It's somewhere in here, maybe not the best way to learn, but as a reference manual, you're not going to get better. So any other questions about printf or standard I/O in general? Okay, so now on to a whole bunch of miscellaneous C topics, starting with a brief note about GoTo. It exists. This is real C code that is valid. You can have labels in C. It's really rarely used feature, but it's a thing you can do. And you can have the keyword GoTo, and this is basically exactly the same as jump in assembly, and the label basically maps directly to a label in assembly. We will sometimes use this in this course because this is the easiest way to represent assembly we're showing you as C. Not because we think you should do this in C, though at least the example on this slide is defensible as a reason to use GoTo in C. Many people will tell you not to do that. Any questions about this example? Yeah. Any difference between this and a? So the label and the function?
If we just made a found function.
Okay, so the question is, could I go to a function? And the answer is no. So even though functions turn into labels in assembly, C will not allow you to go to between functions at all. Just as a rule, yes. So the question is, in this example, after we execute after found, what happens? It executes whatever code's left. If it's the end of the function, it returns. It just keeps going as if we started there. Any other? Yeah.
So there's certain flags in assembly is red. Is there a certain kind of flag like that you need to go to afterwards?
So the question is, what does that return turn into in assembly? Is that?
In assembly, we use jump JMP and red, so we can like jump somewhere and then return back to where it was initially.
Yeah.
So if you jump from and then go to file to file versus print that file name at this point, it just ends there. Does that?
It just goes. It's equivalent to a jump, not a call. So it just goes there. Doesn't remember anything about where it was. There's nothing like, yeah, so this go-to is a jump. I use jump deliberately, it's not a call, there's no return from go-to. It just goes there, it forgets everything about where it was before. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So that's all I'm gonna say about go-to. So let's talk about struct. So I understand you've seen structs in 2150, but apparently very, very briefly. So my brief explanation of what a struct is that it's a class without methods. Aren't allowed to have methods at all. But you have instance variables just like you would in C++, and basically like you would in Java. And we can define a struct like this. So struct rational, it has a numerator and a denominator, and then we can declare instances of that by typing struct space rational. Yes. So the question is there a difference between like a struct and a JSON object? So C doesn't know how to parse JSON.
Yeah, well,
and structs, you have to say what's in them, unlike, you know, sort of things in, like in Python where you use a map, you know, and can you add anything to it? Structs, this contains a numerator and denominator and never anything else. So if you're used to classes in C++ rather, you might be surprised I'm typing struct all the time here. Because in C++, you'd expect something similar to be able to type rational. But in C, you can't do that. If you define a struct rational like this, the name of the type you have is struct space rational. Rational is not a valid type name yet. And that's the main difference from what you may be used to in C++. So there are ways around this. So there's something called typedef. So typedef takes a type name, like in this case, struct other name for rational, and defines a new name for that type, in this case, rational. And in this way, we can turn our use of struct every time we name this struct to not do that, and use the name rational like you might have been used to doing in C++. And in this example, I have a different name for the struct than the type we're producing, but they could be the same, they could not. I have different names just to be clear that they're not tied to be the same name, but in real code you might see typedef struct rational rational. But I felt that would be confusing to have on the slide. And you know, I might say, well, this is nice, but it's still a little unwieldy. Can we make it shorter? And, well, you can. So you can do the typedef in the same line where you define the struct. And that's what this syntax is. We define, it's the same as the above, but we just have one less line. And you'll commonly see this in real C code. So this defines the type rational, which is an alias for the type struct other name for rational, which is defined in the same line of code, same statement. And it has those two names. And you might say, well, I like using the word rational and never typing struct. Why do I have this other name I need to make up? Isn't that wasteful? Why am I bothering doing that? And in fact, C lets you not do that. So if you don't care about having a different name, a name that starts with struct space, you don't need to write one, and you'll commonly see C code do this, where the type this name rational, and there's no other name for it, but it's still a struct. And just because it lets you omit that other name. So any questions about these shorthands? Okay, so there's one case, yeah.
Just the fact that so now bottom example you can just, you don't have to use struct rational.
So in all these examples you don't have to use struct rational.
Okay.
In the bottom example, there's not even another name that you could use. Other questions about this? Okay. So you might say, why do we even bother having this name prefix of a struct? Do I ever need to use that? And there's one important case where you'll see that you have to use that other name in C code. Even if you like type defing, so you don't type struct space all the time. And that's if you want to have a struct that contains a pointer to its own type. So the classic example is let's make a linked list. If you want to make a linked list, I can't use the type list because it doesn't exist until after the semicolon. So I have to use the other name, the struct space list underscore t in this case. That makes sense? Questions? So after I've done this, I can use this list in a way you're hopefully familiar with from 2150, because we've done a bunch of this stuff. And a few things are different about dynamic data structures like this than you were used to in C++. In particular, just like we don't have cout, we don't have new. We have instead malloc. So malloc is a function. And it takes a number of bytes you want to allocate. In this case, it's the size of the list struct. And returns a pointer to that many bytes. And just like you have delete in C++, we have free, which takes something you pass to malloc and frees it. Any questions about this? So malloc, it takes a number of bytes. In this case, it's the size of list, which returns however many bytes it takes to store that struct, and allocates that much memory, just like new would. Yeah?
So there's no new in C.
The question is, there's no new in C. There's no new, no delete. Yes? The question is, malloc returns a void star, aren't you missing a cast? So in C, it turns out that you can convert a void star to any other pointer type without a cast. This is not true in C++, but it is true in C, and I'm taking advantage of it to make my code simpler. Okay, so this is our allocating a linked list. Another thing you've probably done before in 2150 is dynamic arrays. So we don't have an operator new with int 100. You can't do that, but you use malloc. And I said you pass number of bytes, so we compute the size of an array of 100 things. Size of int times 100, that's the amount of space we want to allocate, so that's what we pass to malloc. And unlike C++, there's nothing special about allocating or freeing arrays. It's just a size. So we can free the array without using a different operator like you would in C++. It's the same thing you would use to free a single struct thing that you allocated. Any questions on this? Calculation of size makes sense? Yeah. So the question is, how does free know how big things are? And the answer is basically that malloc needs to keep track of the size it allocated somewhere. And there's multiple strategies used in practice for that, but basically somewhere there's a data structure that malloc allocates and maintains, which has the sizes allocated for everything that was passed returned from malloc.
Okay.
in simple strategies, you put it before the thing you allocated. But there's other things you can do. So this is our standard dynamic array, where we allocate something on the heap, have a pointer to the first thing, which we discussed, acts exactly like a normal array, so it looks like a normal array. So what would you do if you want something like vector in C++? So is this enough? Is there other things vector does that we like? Yeah?
Well, you keep track of the size, and then once it gets to be like final element, that you would create a new array and move all
the way. Yeah, so we need to keep track of the size to like get the full functionality of a vector. And the most straightforward way to do that is to make a struct. So here's a struct for keeping track of a size and a dynamic array. And just like we would allocate a vector of 100 things, we can allocate the struct, set the size to 100, and manually allocate 100 elements worth of space for the data. So it's a little more cumbersome than the vectors you're used to in C++, but it gets you the same functionality. And you can do all the sorts of other things you might do with vectors. But there's one particular example here where I'm doing the equivalent of making a new vec2, setting it equal to vec, and this is what I'm telling you is the equivalent C code for that. We set the size equal, we allocate a new space, and copy everything. So, a question. So why didn't I just do range vec2 equals vec? This is valid C code, will compile and run, but what's wrong with it? Why can't I do that? Even though this is the same thing, you know, works in C++ with vector. Yeah?
Are they sharing, say, the array address?
Yeah, so what this does is it copies each element of the struct one by one. So it takes the pointer, data, and copies it to vec2. So now vec2.data and vec.data point to the same place. And when we modify vec, it modifies vec2. When we free vec.data, it frees vec2.data. So this is not going to do what we expect copying a vector to do in C++. So in C++, they have sort of extra support, which makes this happen sort of behind the scenes. In C, you're going to have to do all that by hand. Yes?
Does C distinguish between public and private variables?
So the question is, does C distinguish between public and private variables? No, everything is public. There's no method, so it doesn't, in classes, so it doesn't really make sense to do that. Any questions about this? Yeah? So what's the difference between range underscore T and range? So range is the name of a type, and struct space range underscore T is the name of a type. So those are the two possible names for that structure. And I deliberately added the underscore T, so it was clear that they were different names, but you could have them both be range, in which case the names would be struct space range and range. And you might see that in real code. I just wanted to make it clear which was which. Yes?
So with the range underscore T, you always have to have the struct before, right?
So the question is, with the range underscore T, you always need the struct before? Yes. Okay, so that's our brief foray into how you do all that dynamic allocation stuff, even though we don't have new and delete. Now some sort of more nitpicky issues. So I think you've seen sign types before. So just note, C has them. These are the sizes on our lab machines. They might be different on other machines. The ranges of the values they hold. There are signed and unsigned variants of all the integer types. For the int ones, you can just type unsigned, and that's an unsigned int. They're the same thing, just different ways of writing it. You can also type signed instead of int if you like confusing people. They're the same thing. And you can type signed long if you really want to be very explicit, but probably won't. And so, unsigned types, which can't hold negative numbers, you know, act mostly intuitively, but there's a few notable cases. So here's some code. So what's the most logical thing for this to output? So remember that our comparison operators return 0 or 1, an integer, so printf's being used correctly here. What should logically the output be? What would you like it to be at least? 1. And as you might guess by me putting this up on the slide, that is not the output. Output is 0, which makes no sense. You know, clearly negative 1 is less than 0. Why is the compiler generating bad code? What's happening? And the short answer for you is that if you ever want to compare a signed value and an unsigned value, you should explicitly convert to a type which can hold all possible values. So in our lab machines, long would work. So that's the workaround. That's how you avoid this problem. And the reason it goes all wrong is that the rules that are set forth for C compilers say convert them both to the same type first, and that type is chosen in a very particular way, and it happens that in this case, the type to convert to that's chosen is unsigned int. Even though that doesn't seem like the best choice. That is what the type that is chosen, that is the correct behavior for the compiler, and that's why the comparison gives you the wrong result. And you might say, who decided that? That's a crazy decision. GCC developers don't know what they're doing. But GCC developers, even though you might think it, generally don't define what C compilers should do. Instead, there's sort of standards. And this has a long history. So way back, some people at AT&T Bell Labs at the time wrote a book called The C Programming Language. And a bunch of people implemented things based on this book. They did what the book said a C compiler should do. And this sort of written specification was taken up by the American National Standards Institute, originally in around 1989, and they wrote a document saying, this is what C compilers should do. And a whole bunch of people implemented C compilers that all followed this document. And there have been revisions since then. And this is what makes C the language that you're used to today. And compilers like GCC even have options to say, I want you to compile like this particular version of that written standard, which you might see. But this is what defines what makes a C compiler and what doesn't, and what your compiler is trying to do. Not trying to do what you expect, it's trying to do what the standard says to do. Yes?
Why do some programming languages like C have standards that are followed by many different compilers, and other languages like Java are proprietary and only have?
So the question is, why do some languages like C have standards that are followed by many compilers, and others like Java don't seem to? So there are some languages which are basically defined by a single implementation. A good example is Python. So Python, you know, for the most, there are some attempts at specification, but for the most part, what the C implementation of Python version 3 does is what Python is. And like no one says anything else. Because no one has cared about having multiple implementations. So for other languages like C, they wanted to have multiple people implement it. So different people with different hardware all wanted to have compatible kind of implementations of C, so they all agreed on a standard. And this happened for other languages too. So Java, you think there's only one implementation, but there is actually something called the Java Language Specification, which is like a 1,000-page book, which says what Java is. And there are other implementations, you just don't use many of them, because they're not very popular, but like IBM has their own implementation of Java, which follows that. And so sometimes they write specifications, but other times they don't care. If you have an implementation, everyone's using it, why do you care about writing down exactly how to make another one? But C and C++ are one of those languages where there's multiple people implementing it, so they try to agree on what to do. And so this standard sometimes does weird things. And I have that one example of signed versus unsigned. Like the standards wrote down rules way back in like 89. And those rules sometimes don't do the thing you'd expect. But But they're the rules in the standard, and the compilers just follow them to be compatible with all the other compilers. So there are other weird things that happen, and there's some concept in these standards called undefined behavior. And here's an example. So what is the most logical thing for this code to output? So int max is a constant which is the maximum possible integer of type int. So someone says zero. So why zero?
The max, it takes up all the bits. Mm-hmm. So for int max, it would have four bits. Wait, no. 32 bits. And overflowing it would make it 33 bits. But it would reset to zero.
So this is a signed integer, but it's the same idea. So adding one to the maximum possible value gives you the minimum, which is the same thing which happened with unsigned. And so you expect number plus one to be a really negative thing. A number is the most positive thing. So you expect zero. And if you compile on, say, a recent version of GCC without optimizations, you'll get zero. If you compile with optimizations, you'll get one. And you might be tempted to say, hey, GCC, you have a bug. Your optimizer changes what the code does, like the answer. That's not what optimizations are supposed to do. And for better or worse, the people who wrote the C language standard don't agree with you. By the C language standard, both of these answers are right. And to make this more concrete, here's the code that's generated, which shows you what's happening. So in the optimized case, GCC looked at this and said, well, number plus one, obviously that's bigger than number. Why do I even bother looking at the argument? I'm just going to return one. So it just moves one to the return value. In the other case, the unoptimized case, it actually does the comparison. And the people who made the C standard decided that they didn't really care what happens when numbers would wrap around. And so they left that as what's called undefined behavior. They said, hey, if adding signed numbers would wrap around, you can do whatever you want, whatever's most convenient. And it's convenient for optimizations to assume it doesn't happen, because this ordinarily is actually a very good optimization. It just happens to be different sometimes. And so the people who made the C standard defined a whole bunch of things as undefined behavior. And that means that the compiler has the freedom to take whatever option it wants. And the sort of formal specification is that when you do anything that's undefined behavior, such as overflowing a signed integer, which is what we're doing there, the compiler can do absolutely whatever it wants. It can crash your program. Like, that would be valid thing, would be to just, if it's int max crash, that would be valid code to generate. It can, you know, do what you expect, it can do something else, it can do something really subtle. Those are all valid. The C standard said, we don't care what programs which make signed integers wrap around do. And the compiler is taking advantage of that. And this is an example that I promised earlier of a case where compilers aren't doing what you would expect, not the straightforward translation. And you can see there's a good reason for it. Like, it makes it so they can make code fast in the common case. But it's certainly not what you expect. And you need to know about it because you probably shouldn't do this undefined behavior stuff. Because you will be very surprised at what happens, because sometimes your program will break, sometimes it won't. Yes?
How much time does not adding one actually save?
So the question is, this claim is basically that this optimization doesn't seem very useful, like, because it's fast. The idea is that the compiler will do the same optimization in the middle of a bigger loop or something like that. In that case, it will start saving a lot of time. When we have other, you know, when this is mixed in with other optimizations, this eventually, this sort of optimization will save a lot of time. I gave a really simple example because, you know, I want to fit the assembly code on one slide. Okay. So I mentioned one kind of this undefined behavior, this case where the C standard threw up their hands, said, I don't care what happens, and that signed, only signed, not unsigned, integer overflow or underflow. So where things wrap around, yes, that's what happens in the hardware, but the compiler isn't required to have that happen. Because C was, their thinking I think was, different hardware does different things, has different size registers, things like that, so we don't care what happens. Compiler doesn't need to do anything in particular. Another big example was out of bounds pointers. So in Java, you're used to if you go outside of an array, you get an exception. In C, that's undefined behavior. The compiler could make your program crash. This is what a segfault is, usually. The compiler could make your program read whatever's in memory somewhere and have it, you know, do something. Those are all valid things because the C standard said, we don't care what you do when someone writes code like this. And there's a full bunch of other examples, integer divide by zero, writing read-only data, and a whole lot of other little things that mostly you shouldn't be doing in well-formed programs. But this is unlike languages like Java you may be used to, where absolutely everything you can do has a single thing that can happen. Here, because they wanted to be flexible and support multiple implementations and not have them meticulously make everything work exactly the same way, they just said, we don't care. But it affects you as a normal programmer. Okay. So any questions about undefined behavior in general? Okay, or anything we talked about? Yeah. So we'll talk about a little bit more C later. But first, we're going to talk about assembly on Thursday. So I'll go over what AT&T syntax is and all that stuff you'll need to know for later this semester. And then we'll go talk about RISA, and then we'll talk a little bit more about something in C. But we're done with C for now.